Welcome back, everyone. We're diving into a topic today that I've always found super fascinating and a little bit spooky, if I'm being honest. Paranormal beliefs.
Oh, definitely spooky, but also incredibly interesting, right?
Totally. I mean, we're talking about all those beliefs about the mind, you know, like ESP and telekinesis and stuff. That existed before science really got a handle on how the brain works.
It's like taking a trip back in time. Before we had MRIs and EEGs, how did people even begin to explain these seemingly impossible things?
Right. And we're not just relying on dusty old books for this deep dive either. We've got scientific studies, cultural observations, even some historical anecdotes that paint a really vivid picture of how people used to think about the mind.
You know, it's kind of amazing how these beliefs persist even today, though, with all our scientific advancements.
That's what blows my mind. You'd think with all we know now about the brain, people would be less likely to believe in things like, I don't know, mind reading or whatever.
Well, surveys actually show that a surprisingly large number of people still hold on to these paranormal beliefs. They haven't gone away. They've just sort of adapted to the times.
So why do you think that is? Why do these beliefs stick around even when science presents a different perspective?
Well, one way to think about it is that for centuries, the human mind was a complete mystery. It was like a black box. People didn't have the tools or the knowledge to understand how it worked, so they filled in the gaps with stories, myths, beliefs.
Right, so they basically came up with explanations based on what they could observe and experience, even if those explanations weren't exactly, you know, scientific.
Exactly. And those beliefs, passed down through generations, became part of what we might call the folklore of the mind, this collection of ideas about the mind's hidden powers and mysterious workings.
Kind of like those old wives' tales, but for the supernatural.
Precisely. And a lot of times, these beliefs stem from this blurry line between subjective experiences and objective reality. What we feel and perceive isn't always a reflection of what's actually happening in the physical world.
It's like that whole thing with the Flat Earth Society. Even with all the evidence that the Earth is a sphere, they still cling to the belief that it's flat.
It's a classic example of how deeply ingrained beliefs can sometimes resist even the most compelling evidence. It's almost like the emotional weight of those beliefs outweighs the logical arguments against them.
It makes you wonder if there's something about the human brain that's just wired to believe in the supernatural.
There might be something to that. But what about the scientific community? You'd think they'd be all over this, trying to debunk these paranormal claims, right?
I know. It's like they're ignoring this whole universe of beliefs about the mind. Why is that?
Well, a lot of scientists are hesitant to engage with these beliefs because they see them as outside the realm of science. Their focus is on things that can be measured and tested rigorously, you know, the scientific method and all that.
Right. But isn't that a little dismissive, though? I mean, aren't scientists missing a chance to understand how our minds work by studying why people believe in these things, even if the things themselves aren't real?
You raise a valid point. There are some researchers who argue that studying paranormal beliefs can actually offer valuable insights into the human brain.
So it's not about proving or disproving the existence of ghosts or psychic powers, but about understanding why people believe in them in the first place.
Precisely. And that's the approach we're going to take in this deep dive. We're going to explore those beliefs, examine the evidence, or lack thereof, and see what they can tell us about ourselves and how our minds work.
So to kick things off, let's define what we mean by paranormal phenomena. What kinds of beliefs are we actually talking about here?
We're talking about things like precognition, which is like knowing the future before it happens, telepathy, which is mind-to-mind communication, and of course ESP, that catch-all term for all sorts of psychic abilities.
The kind of stuff that makes for great movies and TV shows, even if we're not sure if it's actually real.
Exactly. And these beliefs often get mixed up with things like pseudoscience, which basically tries to sound all scientific but doesn't really follow the rules of scientific evidence and testing. They might throw around fancy jargon and cherry-pick data to make their claims seem more credible.
So it's all smoke and mirrors, basically.
Yeah.
But have any real scientists ever taken paranormal research seriously?
There have been attempts, but always with a healthy dose of skepticism, which is crucial in science. True scientists, even when exploring the paranormal, stick to the scientific method.
So they formulate hypotheses, design experiments, analyze the results, all that good stuff.
Exactly. And the goal isn't to prove the paranormal true or false, but to see if there's any actual evidence to support these extraordinary claims.
So they go in with an open mind, but a very critical eye. Not just accepting stories and anecdotes at face value.
Precisely. And unfortunately, over 150 years of research has yielded mostly inconclusive results.
So it's like science has been looking into this stuff for a long time, and it's just not panning out.
Right. And that's led to a decline in university-led paranormal research. It's just not seen as a fruitful area of study by most scientists.
But there are exceptions, right? I mean, there are still some researchers out there who are dedicated to exploring the paranormal.
There are, absolutely. Like the Koestler Parapsychology Unit at the University of Edinburgh. They're still actively researching these phenomena.
Interesting. So they haven't given up hope just yet. And what about that $1 million challenge? Wasn't there some guy who offered a reward to anyone who could prove they had paranormal abilities?
Yes. That was James Randi, the magician and skeptic. He put up $1 million for anyone who could demonstrate genuine paranormal abilities under controlled scientific conditions.
$1 million bucks. That's a lot of money. You'd think Summer would have been able to claim that if these powers were real, right?
You'd think so, right. But nobody ever did. Despite the huge incentive, no one could pass Randy's tests.
So even with all that money on the line, nobody could definitively prove they had real paranormal powers. Makes you wonder, doesn't it?
It really does. Which brings us to this fascinating paradox. We have this lack of scientific evidence, yet belief in these phenomena remains incredibly widespread.
It's like the allure of the unknown, the possibility of these extraordinary powers, is just so strong that it overrides logic and the need for proof.
And that's precisely why it's so important to understand the psychology behind these beliefs. Why do people continue to hold on to them, even in the face of skepticism and contradictory evidence?
So let's dive into some specific beliefs. What about astrology? I mean, millions of people read their horoscopes every day. Is that considered paranormal or just a harmless pastime?
Astrology is a curious case. It's rooted in this ancient idea that the stars and planets can influence human affairs, which made sense back then when people didn't really distinguish between meteorological and astronomical phenomena.
So it's this blend of early astronomy and, well, maybe a little bit of wishful thinking.
Right, exactly. But it's amazing how those beliefs have persisted for so long. We know so much more about the universe now, yet people are still drawn to astrology.
It's like this ancient system of belief that just won't quit. And you know what's even wilder? Back in 2011, the Bombay High Court in India actually declared astrology a science.
It's true. A court of law actually said astrology was a legitimate scientific discipline.
That's crazy. So even though it's embraced by a lot of people and even recognized legally in some places, does astrology actually hold up to scientific scrutiny?
Unfortunately, not really. There have been numerous studies that have debunked the claims of astrology.
So it's culturally significant and even legally recognized in some places, but it doesn't actually pass the science test.
Exactly. One study published in the journal Nature back in 1985 involved 100 of the top astrologers in the UK. They were given personality tests and birth charts and asked to match them up. And guess what? Their results were no better than chance.
So even the best astrologers couldn't prove they could predict anything. They were basically just guessing.
Pretty much. But what about psychics and fortune tellers? How do they convince people they have special insights?
I've always wondered about that. It seems like there's always a market for people who claim to see the future or communicate with the dead.
Well, a lot of it comes down to techniques like cold reading and hot reading.
Oh, I've heard about cold reading. It's like asking really vague questions and then using the person's answers to make it seem like you know more than you do.
Exactly. It's a psychological trick to create the illusion of insight.
And hot reading is when they do some research on you beforehand. Right? Like stalking your social media or something. So they can drop little tidbits of information that make it seem like they're psychic.
Precisely. It's all about creating a convincing performance, even if there's no real substance behind the claims.
So it's like they're playing a character, basically. And people are buying into it because they want to believe.
Right. Another example is this thing called the Mars effect. Astrologers claim there was a correlation between the position of Mars at birth and a person's athletic ability.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about that. So if Mars was in a certain position when you were born, you were destined to be a star athlete.
That was the idea. And at first, some studies suggested there might be a connection. But larger, more controlled studies found no such effect.
So it was just a coincidence?
Most likely. It's a classic case of mistaken correlation for causation. Just because two things happen around the same time doesn't mean one caused the other.
We see this all the time, right? People drawing connections between things that aren't really connected.
Exactly. And let's not even get started on Mercury retrograde.
Oh, gosh, don't even get me started. Yeah. Everybody blames Mercury retrograde for everything that goes wrong in their lives.
It's become this catch-all excuse for bad luck, technology glitches, miscommunication. But in reality, there's no scientific evidence to support the idea that the apparent backward motion of Mercury has any actual impact on our lives.
It's fascinating how we cling to those explanations, even when they're based on superstition or misunderstandings about how the universe works.
It speaks to this deep-seated need we have to find meaning and order in a world that can often feel random and chaotic. We want to believe there are reasons for things, even if those reasons are based on ancient myths or astronomical events.
So it's like we're trying to impose a sense of control on a world that's often unpredictable and beyond our control.
Absolutely. And that brings us to another fascinating realm of paranormal belief. UFOs and alien abductions.
Okay, now we're talking. Everybody loved the good alien story. But seriously, where did this whole fascination with UFOs even begin?
It goes way back, even further than you might think. In the late 1800s, people were already speculating about life on Mars, fueled by these observations of what they thought were canals on the red planet. Later, the moon also became a focus for extraterrestrial imaginings.
So the seeds of our alien obsession were planted long before the modern UFO era.
Exactly. It's like this idea of life beyond Earth has been lurking in our collective imagination for a long, long time. And then, of course, in the mid-20th century, UFO sightings started popping up all over the world.
It was like this explosion of interest in aliens and flying saucers.
Right. And it captured the public's imagination like nothing else. People were seeing strange lights in the sky, reporting encounters with mysterious beings. It was the beginning of the modern UFO era.
I remember reading about Carl Jung's take on UFOs. He saw them as a modern-day archetype, replacing angels and demons in our collective unconscious.
Jung had this fascinating theory that UFOs represented a deep-seated human need to believe in something beyond ourselves. Like we're searching for meaning and connection with something bigger than our everyday lives.
So instead of angels coming down from heaven, we have aliens coming down from space.
Exactly. It's like our beliefs evolve and adapt to changing cultural contexts. But what about the government? What role have they played in all this UFO stuff?
Well, the U.S. government has funded programs like SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. So they're clearly open to the possibility of extraterrestrial life out there somewhere. But that doesn't stop people from believing that the government's hiding something, right? I mean, those conspiracy theories about crashed UFOs and alien cover-ups are super popular.
Oh, absolutely. And the Roswell incident is a perfect example of how a single event, shrouded in mystery and fueled by speculation, can become this cultural phenomenon.
Roswell, the holy grail of UFO conspiracies. I mean, what really happened there back in 1947?
The official story is that it was a weather balloon that crashed. But for UFO enthusiasts, it's this undeniable proof of alien visitation and a massive government cover-up.
So it's become the symbol of distrust in authority and the belief that we're not being told the whole truth. It's interesting how these beliefs can reflect broader societal anxieties and a sense of alienation from those in power.
Absolutely. And then more recently, we have the Pentagon releasing reports on UAPs, or unidentified aerial phenomena.
UAPs? Is that just a fancy new term for UFOs?
Essentially, yes. They're trying to move away from the pop culture baggage associated with the term UFO, but it's basically the same thing. These reports acknowledge that there have been sightings of objects in the sky that defy easy explanation.
So even the military is admitting they don't have all the answers. Does this mean they're finally taking the possibility of aliens seriously? Or is there a more down-to-earth explanation for these UAPs?
Well, it's important to remember that just because something can't be easily explained doesn't mean it's aliens.
Right, right. Occam's razor and all that. The simplest explanation is usually the best.
Exactly. Most of these UAP sightings are probably due to things like pilot misinterpretations, weather phenomena, you know, even camera glitches.
So it's back to the importance of critical thinking, not jumping to conclusions just because we see something weird in the sky.
Absolutely. But speaking of weird and unexplainable, let's talk about alien abductions.
Oh boy, alien abductions. This is where things get really interesting. The stories are often so detailed, so emotionally charged. Are people really being whisked away in the middle of the night for alien medical experiments? Or is there something else going on?
It's a question that's fascinated researchers for decades. Surveys show a surprisingly high number of people believe they've been abducted by aliens. But is there any evidence to back up those claims?
Yeah, that's the thing, right? There's this huge gap between the number of people who believe they've been abducted, and the lack of any real physical evidence.
Right. And one of the leading researchers in this field, Susan Clancy, has suggested that these experiences might be more about psychology and sleep disturbances than actual extraterrestrial encounters.
So is she saying these people are just imagining things, or is there a more nuanced explanation?
Not necessarily imagining things, but Clancy's research points to something called sleep paralysis as a possible explanation for many of these abduction accounts.
Sleep paralysis. Yeah, I've heard of that. It's that terrifying feeling of being awake but unable to move, like you're trapped in your own body.
Huh.
I've heard it can happen when you're falling asleep or waking up.
Exactly. And during sleep paralysis, the brain can generate these incredibly vivid hallucinations. People report feeling a presence in the room, a sense of being watched or even touched. Sometimes they hear strange noises or feel pressure on their chest.
It's like your brain is creating a horror movie while you're half asleep. No wonder people find it so disturbing.
Right. And in a culture where these alien abduction narratives are so prevalent, it's understandable that some people might interpret those sleep paralysis experiences as encounters with extraterrestrials.
So instead of demons or monsters, it's little green men conducting medical probes.
Wow, that's really interesting. Our cultural stories and beliefs really do shape how we experience the world, even in those really personal, unsettling moments.
They do. They provide a framework for interpreting our experiences, especially those that are difficult to explain. But haven't some researchers taken these abduction claims more at face value? Like actually believing that people are being abducted by aliens.
Yes, there have been researchers who have taken that approach. John Mack, a psychiatrist from Harvard, actually dedicated a large part of his career to studying alien abductions.
So he was convinced that these abductions were real.
He believed that these experiences, even if they weren't literally true, held profound psychological significance for the individuals who reported them.
So he was more focused on the psychological impact of these beliefs than on proving whether aliens actually existed.
Exactly. He used hypnosis to help people recall their abduction experiences, believing that those narratives, even if they were symbolic, could reveal deep-seated anxieties and a need to make sense of the world.
It's a more nuanced approach, acknowledging the power of belief and the impact these experiences can have on people's lives, even if they don't involve literal alien encounters.
Right. And we can't forget the role that media and popular culture play in shaping these beliefs. Movies, TV shows, books, they all contribute to our fascination with aliens and UFOs.
It's like a feedback loop. The more we see aliens in entertainment, the more likely we are to interpret unexplained events as extraterrestrial.
Exactly. And it goes beyond just entertainment, too. There are entire subcultures dedicated to these beliefs. Have you ever heard of Otherkin?
Otherkin? No, I don't think so. What's that?
Otherkin are communities of people who believe that they're not entirely human. They might identify as elves, fairies, dragons, you know, those kinds of mythical creatures.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting. So they believe that their souls or their identities are somehow connected to these otherworldly beings.
Exactly. It's a testament to the power of belief and the human need to create meaning and identity, even if those beliefs challenge our conventional understanding of reality.
Okay, so we've talked about UFOs, alien abductions, and even people who believe they're mythical creatures. Where do we go from here on our paranormal journey?
Let's explore a phenomenon that has captured the human imagination for centuries. Levitation, the idea of defying gravity, of floating through the air. You've probably heard stories of levitating monks or yogis.
Yeah, the image of someone just floating in midair is so captivating. But I have to admit, I'm a bit skeptical. Are there any real-life examples of levitation, or is it all just illusions and tricks?
Throughout history, there have been countless accounts of levitation, from ancient mystics to religious figures. But of course, most of these accounts are anecdotal and often tied to religious beliefs. But in the 20th century, there was this figure who emerged who really brought the idea of levitation into the mainstream, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi.
Wait, wasn't he the guru who became famous for teaching transcendental meditation to the Beatles?
The very same. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi claimed that through a technique called yoga flying, practitioners of transcendental meditation could achieve a state of weightlessness and even hop short distances.
Hold on, hopping. That doesn't quite sound as impressive as, you know, actually floating through the air.
Well, that's kind of the point. While Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's teachings on transcendental meditation gained widespread attention, his claims of yogic flying were met with a lot of skepticism from the scientific community.
So another case of these intriguing claims clashing with the need for solid evidence. Did anyone ever actually investigate these levitating yogis?
There were a number of studies conducted on the physiological effects of transcendental meditation, and some did show positive results in terms of reducing stress and promoting relaxation, but none of these studies supported the claims of actual levitation.
So, even with all that research, nobody could prove that these yogis were truly defying gravity.
Right. And when you actually look closely at the technique of yogic flying, it becomes clear that it's more about a series of coordinated hops and jumps than actual sustained levitation.
So it's like a really well choreographed illusion.
Exactly. And it plays on our expectations, our desire to believe in something extraordinary.
Are there any other explanations for how this idea of levitation has persisted for so long, besides, you know, wishful thinking and clever illusions?
Some people believe that what appears to be levitation in certain spiritual practices might be related to muscle contractions during deep meditation, or even misinterpretations of cymatics.
Cymatics. I'm not familiar with that term. What is that?
It's the study of how sound waves create visible patterns and shapes in various materials, like liquids or powders. Some people believe that certain sounds or vibrations might be able to create the illusion of levitation, especially when combined with things like dim lighting and other stagecraft techniques.
So it's a mix of physics, psychology, and a little bit of showmanship.
Right. Even seemingly impossible feats can often be explained by natural phenomena or just clever tricks.
Well, our brains are easily fooled, that's for sure. Speaking of mind-boggling abilities, what other psychic powers have scientists investigated? Besides levitation, I mean.
Well, there's telepathy, of course, that classic mind-to-mind connection that's always been a staple of science fiction.
Telepathy.
Yeah.
Who hasn't wished they could read someone else's mind at some point? But is there any scientific basis for it? Has anyone ever been able to prove it's real?
Early research on telepathy often involved these cards called Zener cards. They have those simple symbols on them, like circles and squares and wavy lines.
Oh yeah, I've seen those. I think they sell them in magic shops. They were actually used in scientific experiments.
They were. Researchers used them to test whether people could transmit images or thoughts to each other without any sensory cues. Like a controlled test of mind reading, basically.
So, did it work? Could people actually transmit thoughts to each other using those cards?
Well, some early experiments showed some promising results, but those results were often inconsistent and difficult to replicate in later studies.
So another fascinating idea that didn't quite pan out scientifically, what about remote viewing? I've heard that term before. What does it mean exactly?
Remote viewing is this idea that people can see distant locations or events using their psychic abilities. Sounds like something out of spy movie, right?
It does. So like psychic espionage.
Exactly. And you know what's really interesting? The CIA actually conducted experiments on remote viewing during the Cold War.
The CIA? Seriously? They were really looking into psychic spies.
They were. They wanted to see if psychic abilities could be used for intelligence gathering. But as with a lot of paranormal research, the results were mixed. Some reports claimed statistically significant findings, while others were much less conclusive. And the interpretation of those results is often pretty subjective and open to bias.
It seems like we keep running into this wall of ambiguity. There are these hints of something extraordinary, but the evidence never seems to solidify.
That's the nature of paranormal research. It often operates in this murky space between possibility and proof. But it's also what makes it so fascinating to explore.
Okay, so what about other mind-bending abilities? What have scientists found, you know, besides telepathy and remote viewing?
Well, there's a whole area of research focused on the influence of human intention on random events.
So, like the idea that our thoughts can influence the outcome of a coin toss or the roll of a die, like we can will something to happen just by thinking about it.
Exactly. There was this organization called the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research, or KEIR, that conducted experiments to see if people could intentionally influence the output of random event generators.
Random event generators. What are those?
They're devices that generate random sequences of numbers, like electronic coin flips. The idea was to see if people could use their minds to make those random numbers less random.
So, did it work? Could people actually influence the random number generators with their thoughts?
The results were, once again, mixed. Peer claimed they found statistically significant deviations from randomness, but their findings were challenged by other researchers who questioned their methodology and statistical analyses.
It seems like that's a recurring theme in paranormal research. One study finds something interesting, but then it can't be replicated or the methods are questioned.
Replication is crucial in science. If a finding can't be independently verified, it's really difficult to accept it as evidence.
What about the Global Consciousness Project? I've heard they're using random event generators to study whether major world events can have a measurable impact on, like, the collective consciousness of humanity.
The Global Consciousness Project is a fascinating ongoing experiment. They have this network of random event generators placed all over the world, and they're constantly monitoring the data to see if there are any correlations between global events, like major disasters or celebrations, and deviations in the randomness of the numbers generated by those devices.
So it's like they're looking for evidence that human consciousness, collectively, might have some kind of measurable impact on the physical world.
Exactly. The idea is that if there's a big enough shift in global consciousness, it might be reflected in these subtle changes in the random number generators.
Have they found any evidence to support this global consciousness hypothesis?
That's a subject of ongoing debate. Some analyses suggest there might be some correlations, but others argue those findings could just be due to chance or statistical artifacts. It's an area that definitely requires further investigation and more rigorous analysis.
So, back to that realm of uncertainty again. It seems like every time we think we might be getting close to some kind of breakthrough, we end up back in the gray area. But that's part of what makes this topic so intriguing, right?
It is. It keeps us asking questions, seeking answers, and pushing the boundaries of what we know about ourselves and the universe. But before we wrap up this part of our deep dive, let's talk about a couple more mind-boggling claims. What about precognition, the idea of knowing the future?
Precognition. Like having a premonition or a vision of something that's going to happen. It's a common theme in movies and TV shows, but is there any evidence to suggest it's a real phenomenon?
There have been some intriguing studies on precognition. Professor Daryl Bem, for instance, conducted research that seemed to suggest that precognition might be real.
Really? So what did his research show?
Bem designed these experiments where participants seemed to react to stimuli before they were actually presented.
So it's like they were having premonitions of what was about to happen.
That's the implication. However, his research was met with a lot of criticism. Critics argued that his findings could be explained by other factors and pointed out some methodological flaws in his experiments.
So another intriguing idea that hasn't quite stood up to scientific scrutiny?
Right. But it highlights the challenges studying these phenomena. It's often difficult to design experiments that can definitively rule out other explanations or control for all the possible variables.
What about telekinesis? The ability to move objects with the power of your mind.
Telekinesis, the classic image of someone bending spoons with their mind. Uri Geller was famous for those demonstrations.
Oh yeah, Uri Geller.
Right.
The spoon bender. But weren't those demonstrations debunked? Like he was using trickery or something?
Many magicians and skeptics have pointed out that Geller's feats could be replicated using sleight of hand and other magic techniques.
So, another case of illusion, masquerading as a paranormal ability. It's amazing how easily our perceptions can be manipulated.
It is. But there's also this concept of synchronicity, which was popularized by Carl Jung. It refers to these seemingly meaningful coincidences that occur in our lives.
So like when you're thinking about someone and then they suddenly call you, or you keep seeing the same number everywhere you go.
Exactly. Some people interpret those events as evidence of telepathy or some kind of interconnectedness between minds. But skeptics argue that these coincidences can be explained by probability and the sheer number of events that happen in our lives every day.
It's like that saying, millions of monkeys typing for millions of years will eventually produce the works of Shakespeare. Given enough time and enough events, even the most unlikely coincidences are bound to happen.
That's a great analogy. It highlights the importance of not reading too much into random events. But let's move on to another intriguing area of paranormal belief. Dowsing.
Dowsing. That's the practice of using a forked stick or a pendulum to find water or other hidden objects, right? Mm-hmm. It seems like something straight out of folklore. Do people still practice that today?
They do. Dowsing is an ancient practice that's still quite widespread, despite the skepticism from the scientific community.
So what do the skeptics say? Do dowsing rods actually work? Or is it just wishful thinking?
James Randi, the magician and skeptic we mentioned earlier, conducted lots of tests on dowsers and found no evidence that they could actually detect anything. He argued that many dowsers were sincere in their beliefs, but were likely deceiving themselves.
So even though they believed they had this ability, their dowsing rods weren't really pointing them to anything real.
Exactly. And there was a large-scale study done by a researcher named H.D. Betts that involved over 500 dowsers. And they couldn't find any correlation between the dowsers' claims and the actual presence of water.
So it seems like another case where belief trumps evidence. It's incredible how people can be so convinced of their own abilities, even when the evidence suggests otherwise.
It speaks to the power of suggestion, the influence of our expectations, and this human desire to find patterns and meaning in the world, even when those patterns might not actually exist.
It's a good reminder that we all have biases and preconceived notions that can color our perceptions. That's why it's so important to approach these paranormal claims with a healthy dose of skepticism.
Skepticism is essential. It helps us avoid falling prey to false beliefs and potentially harmful practices. It's about questioning assumptions, demanding evidence, and being open to changing our minds when presented with new information.
It's about being a discerning consumer of information, especially in today's world, where we're constantly bombarded with all sorts of claims and pseudoscientific ideas.
Right. And a great example of the importance of skepticism is this prank that was pulled by British astronomer Patrick Moore back in 1976. He went on BBC Radio 2 and announced that at a specific time, a rare planetary alignment would create a temporary reduction in gravity.
Wait, he was joking, right? He told people they could experience weightlessness because of a planetary alignment.
He did, and hundreds of listeners called into the radio station to report that they had indeed felt lighter or even floated for a moment during the time he specified.
Wow, that's hilarious. It's like the placebo effect, but for gravity.
Exactly. It shows how powerful suggestion and expectation can be. And speaking of the placebo effect, it's been shown to play a role in all sorts of beliefs, even those related to technology.
Oh, yeah, like how people claim to hear huge differences between expensive audio cables, even though blind tests have shown that those differences are basically imperceptible.
Exactly. People are willing to pay a premium for a perceived improvement that's all in their heads.
It's a good reminder that our subjective experiences aren't always a reliable reflection of reality.
Precisely. Which brings us back to the importance of skepticism, especially when dealing with the paranormal. It encourages us to look for simpler explanations, to consider alternative perspectives, and to demand evidence before we accept extraordinary claims.
So it's about being curious, but also cautious, embracing the wonder of the unknown, but staying grounded in critical thinking.
Absolutely. And even with a skeptical mindset, some of these paranormal beliefs tap into these really profound questions about the nature of consciousness and the possibility of life after death, like the idea of an immortal soul. Is there a part of us that survives the death of the body? Can the mind exist independently of the brain?
These are questions that have fascinated humanity for centuries, and they continue to intrigue us, even with all our scientific advancements.
They do. So let's delve into those questions a little deeper. Let's start with spiritism, the belief that it's possible to communicate with the spirits of the dead.
I've always been curious about seances and mediums and all that. Is there any truth to those claims, or is it all just wishful thinking and clever trickery?
Spiritism gained a lot of popularity in the late 19th century, filled by stories like the Fox sisters in the U.S., who claimed they could communicate with spirits through rapping sounds.
So it's like the Victorian era's version of those ghost hunting shows we have today. But was there any real evidence to support these claims of spirit communication?
Skeptics at the time, including Michael Faraday, who was a brilliant physicist, investigated these phenomena and found evidence of trickery and unconscious movements by the participants. He showed how people could unknowingly move a planchette on a Ouija board, creating the illusion that it was being guided by spirits.
So it was like a parlor trick. A clever way to manipulate people's beliefs and create a sense of mystery.
Right. But even with those debunkings, the interest in spiritism didn't fade away. People continued to hold seances and seek out mediums who claimed they could channel messages from the other side.
It's amazing how these beliefs can persist even when confronted with evidence that contradicts them. What about Harry Houdini? Wasn't he a big opponent of spiritism?
Yes. Houdini was initially very interested in finding genuine evidence of life after death. He had a very close relationship with his mother, and when she passed away, he was devastated.
So he hoped that maybe spiritism could provide some comfort, some way to connect with her again.
Exactly. But after witnessing so many fraudulent mediums and seeing how they used trickery to exploit people's grief, he became a dedicated debunker of spiritism.
So he used his knowledge of magic and illusion to expose the fakes and protect people from being taken advantage of.
He did. And what's really interesting is that after Houdini's death, his wife continued to hold seances for 10 years, hoping to receive a message from him.
Did she ever get that message from Houdini?
They had a secret code, but despite her efforts, she never received any verifiable communication from beyond the grave.
Wow, that's both heartbreaking and inspiring. It shows Houdini's commitment to the truth, even in death. But what about the bigger question of life after death? Is there any scientific evidence to suggest that consciousness continues after the body dies?
That's a question that science has grappled with for a long time. And in 1975, a psychiatrist named Raymond Moody published a book called Life After Death that really sparked a lot of interest in near-death experiences, or NDEs.
I've heard about those. People report seeing a bright light floating above their bodies, even encountering deceased loved ones. It's pretty powerful stuff.
Moody's book described these common elements that were reported by people who had been close to death, often during cardiac arrest or other life-threatening medical emergencies. And these NDEs started to be seen by some as evidence that consciousness could continue even when the body was shutting down.
So it's like a glimpse into the afterlife, a suggestion that our souls or our consciousness can exist independently of our physical bodies.
Right. But while some people see NDEs as proof of an afterlife, there are alternative explanations that are more grounded in science.
So what are some of those alternative explanations?
Well, some researchers believe that NDEs are hallucinations produced by the dying brain, perhaps as a result of oxygen deprivation or the release of certain neurochemicals.
So it's like the brain is creating this comforting or even ecstatic experience as it's shutting down, a way to cope with the trauma of death.
Exactly. Others have argued that the tunnel vision often reported in NDEs might actually be related to the physiological changes that occur in the brain during extreme G-forces.
So like what fighter pilots experience.
Right. Instead of a mystical journey to another realm, it's a physiological response to a stressful situation.
Makes sense. And I imagine there are concerns about the reliability of people's memories of these NDEs, especially if they're recalling them years after the event.
Absolutely. Memory is incredibly fallible, and we tend to reshape and reinterpret our memories over time. It's possible that those memories of NDEs become embellished or influenced by cultural narratives about the afterlife.
The further we are from the experience, the less accurate our memories might be.
Right. Another key figure in NDE research is a Dutch cardiologist named Pim van Lommel. He did a lot of research on NDEs and argued that they provided evidence for the survival of consciousness beyond the body.
So he was convinced that NDEs were proof of an afterlife.
He was. But his research relied heavily on anecdotal evidence, and he drew conclusions that went beyond what the data actually supported. And even defining clinical death is tricky. It's not a simple on-off switch. It's a more fluid process. And not everyone who experiences cardiac arrest has an NDE.
It seems like there's still a lot we don't understand about what happens in the brain during those liminal states between life and death.
There is, and that's why it's so important to approach these claims with a healthy dose of skepticism and to be cautious about drawing firm conclusions.
So what about the AWARE study? That was designed to provide more definitive evidence of out-of-body experiences during cardiac arrest, right?
The AWARE study was a really ambitious attempt to test the validity of out-of-body experiences. They placed visual targets in areas that would only be visible from above, with the idea that if someone had an out-of-body experience during cardiac arrest, they might be able to report seeing those targets.
So it was like a high-stakes game of hide-and-seek for the soul.
Exactly. But despite years of research and thousands of patients, the AWARE study didn't provide any conclusive evidence to support the existence of out-of-body experiences.
So another swing and a miss for those hoping to find proof of the soul leaving the body.
It's important to remember that the absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence. Just because we haven't found definitive proof of an afterlife doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Science is a process of discovery, and there's still so much we don't know about the universe and the nature of consciousness.
Absolutely. But it's also important to be cautious about claims that go beyond the evidence or that use scientific-sounding language to promote ideas that haven't been rigorously tested.
So back to that balance between open-mindedness and healthy skepticism. But what about the physiological and neurological explanations for near-death experiences? If they're not evidence of the soul leaving the body, what's actually happening in the brain during these experiences?
Well, there are a number of theories. One theory is that NDEs could be related to anoxia, which is oxygen deprivation to the brain. This can happen during cardiac arrest or other medical emergencies.
So if the brain isn't getting enough oxygen, it could trigger these unusual experiences.
Exactly. Anoxia can cause a surge of electrical activity in the brain, which might explain the vivid hallucinations and feelings of euphoria often reported in NDEs.
It's like the brain's going into overdrive as it's being starved of oxygen.
Right. It's a strange paradox. And then there's hypercapnia, which is a buildup of carbon dioxide in the blood. This can also lead to altered states of consciousness, including hallucinations.
So another physiological change that could contribute to these NDEs.
And we can't forget about endorphins, the body's natural painkillers, and mood elevators. In stressful situations, the brain releases a flood of endorphins, which might explain the feelings of peace and joy that some people experience during NDEs.
It's like the brain's way of coping with a traumatic event.
Exactly. And some researchers believe that the release of other neurochemicals, like DMT, might also play a role in these experiences.
DMT, isn't that a powerful psychedelic?
It is, and it's actually produced naturally in the brain. It's released during birth, during death, and possibly during near-death experiences as well.
So our brains are capable of producing those otherworldly experiences without us even having to take any drugs.
Exactly. The brain is a fascinating and complex organ, capable of producing all sorts of unusual experiences. And there's also the phenomenon of tunnel vision, which is a common element of NDEs. Some researchers believe that this might be related to the visual cortex shutting down progressively from the periphery inward, creating the illusion of a tunnel.
So not a mystical pathway to another realm, but a physiological response in the brain.
Exactly. And there are even some parallels between NDEs and the REM sleep state.
REM sleep. That's when we dream, right? What's the connection there?
During REM sleep, our brains are very active, and we experience those vivid, often bizarre dreams. Some of the features of NDEs, like those out-of-body experiences and feelings of detachment, are very similar to what people report experiencing during REM sleep.
So it's like the brain's accidentally entering a dreamlike state during these stressful near-death situations.
That's one theory. And there's also the locus coeruleus, which is a small area in the brainstem. It's involved in regulating arousal and attention, and some researchers believe it might play a role in those feelings of euphoria and transcendence that are often reported in NDEs.
So it's like a little happiness generator in the brain.
In a way, yes. It has connections to the amygdala, which processes emotions, and the nucleus accumbens, which is involved in pleasure and reward. So there's this complex interplay of brain regions and neurochemicals that could potentially explain those unique features of NDEs.
It makes sense that there would be multiple factors at play.
Right. But there's this argument that's often used to support the idea that the mind isn't just a product of the brain.
What's that?
Some people point to electromagnetic pulses, or EMPs, as evidence. You know how EMPs can disrupt electronics but don't seem to affect our consciousness?
Yeah.
They argue that this suggests that the mind isn't material and therefore can't be explained solely by brain activity.
So they're saying that because a magnet can wipe a hard drive but doesn't make us forget our memories, there must be something more to the mind than just the physical brain.
That's the gist of it. But this argument sort of overlooks some key differences between how EMPs affect electronics and how they affect the brain.
Okay, so what are those differences?
EMPs disrupt electronics by inducing these huge currents in wires and circuits. But the brain isn't a simple electrical circuit. It's an incredibly complex network of neurons that communicate through electrochemical signals.
Oh, it's a much more sophisticated and resilient system.
Exactly. And while strong magnetic fields, like those used in fMRI, can actually influence brain activity, they don't disrupt consciousness in the same way that an EMP can fry a computer chip.
So comparing how EMPs affect a computer to how they affect the brain isn't really a fair comparison.
Right. And in every single case of brain damage, whether it's from an injury, a stroke, or a disease, there are always some kind of mental consequences.
Which suggests pretty strongly that the mind is inextricably linked to the brain.
Exactly. But that doesn't mean we've solved the mystery of consciousness or answered those age-old questions about the soul and the possibility of life after death.
It's one of those enduring mysteries that keeps us searching for answers. So let's move on to another intriguing concept, reincarnation. The idea that our souls are reborn into new bodies after we die. Is there any evidence to support this belief?
Reincarnation is a fascinating concept, and it's a belief that's found in many cultures and religions around the world.
It's a central tenet of Hinduism and Buddhism, and it's actually gaining popularity in Western cultures as well. But is there anything more to it than just a comforting belief?
A psychiatrist named Ian Stevenson dedicated much of his career to investigating reincarnation. He traveled all over the world, interviewing children who claimed to remember past lives.
So he was trying to find evidence that these children's memories were genuine and not just fantasies or made-up stories. What did he find?
He documented hundreds of cases of children who had these incredibly detailed and vivid memories of past lives, often including very specific information about people and places they had never encountered in their current lives.
But how could he be sure that those memories were real? Couldn't they have been influenced by their families or their culture?
That's the main criticism of Stevenson's research. It's very difficult to rule out those alternative explanations. And while his work was certainly intriguing, it hasn't been widely accepted by the scientific community.
Right. And while Stevenson's research was definitely interesting, it hasn't really been widely accepted by the scientific community.
So reincarnation, it's still a big question mark. Pretty much. But let's shift gears a little bit and talk about another phenomenon that's often linked to this idea of the soul or consciousness existing outside the body, out-of-body experiences, or OBEs.
OBEs, yeah.
Yes.
The classic image of seeing yourself from above, like you're floating outside your own body. Are these experiences real, or are they just illusions created by the brain?
OBEs are often reported in near-death experiences, but they can also happen in other situations, like during meditation or intense physical exertion or even certain medical conditions.
So they're not just limited to those who are close to death.
Right, and the question is, what's actually happening in the brain when someone has an OBE?
Yeah, is there a scientific explanation for this feeling of leaving your body?
Research on how the brain represents the body suggests that OBEs can be induced by stimulating certain parts of the brain, specifically the temporoparietal junction, or TPJ.
The TPJ. So if you stimulate this part of the brain, you can make someone feel like they're having an out-of-body experience.
Exactly. It's like you're tricking the brain into perceiving the self as being located outside the physical body.
The brain is so weird.
It is. And a neuroscientist named Henrik Ehrsson did some fascinating experiments using virtual reality to create these out-of-body illusions.
So he was basically using VR to make people feel like they were floating outside their bodies.
Exactly. He manipulated the visual and tactile feedback to create this really convincing illusion of being in a different location from the physical body.
It's amazing how our brains can be tricked into believing things that aren't really there.
It really is. And another neuroscientist named Olaf Blank has shown that OBEs can also be induced using ketamine, you know, that anesthetic drug that can create these dissociative effects.
So both brain stimulation and certain drugs can create the sensation of leaving the body.
Right, which suggests that OBEs might not be these mystical experiences, but rather they're products of the brain's ability to construct a sense of self and a representation of the body in space.
It's like our brains are constantly building this model of reality, and sometimes that model can get a little glitchy or distorted.
That's a great way to put it. It really highlights the flexibility of our perceptions and the brain's power to create experiences that feel incredibly real even when they're not.
It makes you wonder what else our brains are capable of.
It does. But, you know, one thing that's become really clear throughout this exploration of paranormal beliefs is this tendency towards human gullibility.
Yeah, it's like this constant thread that runs through so many of these beliefs, this willingness to accept extraordinary claims, even without much evidence.
It speaks to that deep human desire to believe in something beyond the ordinary, something that transcends our everyday experience.
We want to believe in magic and miracles and the possibility that there's more to life than meets the eye.
Exactly. And that desire is especially strong when we look at claims of miraculous healings.
Faith healing. Yeah, it's a topic that's always fascinated me. Seems like every culture has stories of people being cured of illnesses through prayer or some kind of divine intervention.
Right. And it taps into this very deep human need for hope and healing, especially when faced with illness and suffering.
But is there any scientific basis for these claims of faith healing?
That's where things get a bit tricky. While there are tons of anecdotal accounts of miraculous recoveries, it's often difficult to separate those from spontaneous remission, you know, where the body just heals itself naturally.
Or the placebo effect.
Exactly. The placebo effect is incredibly powerful, and it can lead to real improvements in symptoms, even if there's no actual change in the underlying condition.
It's like the mind can convince the body to heal itself.
In a way, yes, and confirmation bias also plays a big role here. We tend to focus on the cases where people get better and ignore the cases where they don't.
So if we believe in faith healing, we're more likely to remember those stories that confirm our beliefs.
Precisely, and we can't underestimate the power of suggestion. A charismatic healer combined with a really strong belief on the part of the patient can create a really powerful placebo effect.
It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way.
Right, and then there are cases like Anatoly Kashpirovsky, that Russian faith healer who became a media sensation in the late 1980s.
Oh yeah, I remember reading about him. He claimed to be able to heal people through television broadcasts.
It was wild. People were fainting and going into trances during his broadcasts, all fueled by this belief that he could heal them through the television.
Mass hysteria on a grand scale.
Exactly. And while some people claim to have experienced real improvements in their health, a lot of it was probably due to the placebo effect or psychosomatic symptoms.
So the power of belief can have a huge impact on both the mind and the body.
Absolutely. But it's also a reminder that we need to be critical of what we see and hear, especially when it comes to these extraordinary claims.
You'll believe everything you see on TV.
Especially not when it comes to faith healing.
Okay, so we've talked about a lot of different paranormal beliefs and phenomena.
Yeah.
But what about the attempts to scientifically prove the existence of the soul?
Ah, the quest to weigh the soul.
Didn't some doctor actually try to measure the weight of the soul at the moment of death?
He did in the early 1900s. Dr. Duncan McDougall conducted these experiments where he placed dying patients on a sensitive scale and observed if there were any changes in their weight at the moment of death.
And did he find anything?
He claimed to observe a consistent weight loss of about 21 grams.
21 grams, that's where the movie title comes from.
Exactly. But his experiments were widely criticized for their flawed methodology and lack of scientific rigor.
So did he actually manage to weigh the soul?
Unfortunately, no. His sample size was tiny, only 6 patients, and the results weren't even consistent. And there are much simpler explanations for the weight loss he observed.
Like what?
Well, the body loses weight through perspiration and respiration, especially when someone's under stress or ill.
So he was probably just measuring the loss of bodily fluids, not the departure of the soul.
Right. It seems like he was really trying to find evidence to support his pre-existing beliefs.
It's a good reminder that even when something sounds scientific, we need to look closely at the methods and the evidence.
Absolutely. And speaking of reaching for explanations, there's the curious case of William Mumler, the first spirit photographer, back in the mid-1800s.
Wait, spirit photographer? Was he claiming to capture images of ghosts?
He was. Mumler claimed that his photography could capture the images of spirits alongside living people.
So basically the Victorian era version of those ghost hunting shows where they try to get photos of orbs and shadowy figures.
Exactly. But later it was revealed that Mumler was using double exposure techniques to create the illusion of ghostly figures in his photos.
So he was faking it.
He was playing on people's grief and their desire to believe that they could still connect with their deceased loved ones.
Another case of trickery and illusion. It's amazing how, even in photography, where we think of the camera as this objective tool for capturing reality, there's still room for manipulation and deception.
Right. And then there's this persistent belief in psychic energy. You know, this idea that there's a life force that can survive death.
Like an energy field connected to our consciousness that lingers even after the body dies.
Exactly. But this notion of psychic energy kind of clashes with the laws of physics, specifically the concept of entropy.
Entropy? Isn't that a measure of disorder or randomness? How does that relate to psychic energy?
Entropy is this fundamental principle in thermodynamics. It basically states that in a closed system, disorder always increases over time.
Okay.
Living organisms are highly ordered systems. We maintain our structure and function by taking in energy and expelling waste. But when we die, that process stops, our bodies decompose, and the energy that once animated us dissipates back into the environment.
So scientifically speaking, the idea of this energy field associated with our consciousness surviving after death is pretty unlikely.
It would go against everything we know about how energy works in the universe.
So it's back to that balance between being open to the possibility of something beyond our current understanding and recognizing the limitations of what we can scientifically prove.
Right. And, you know, there's this phenomenon that actually provides some really interesting insight into how the brain creates sensations and experiences, even when there's no external stimuli, phantom limb syndrome.
Phantom limb syndrome. That's when people who have lost a limb still feel sensations in that missing limb, right?
Exactly. It's a fascinating example of the brain's plasticity and how it can create this persistent representation of the body, even when parts of it are missing.
So even though the limb is gone, the brain still remembers it and creates these phantom sensations.
Right. The brain continues to receive signals from the nerves that were once connected to the missing limb, and it interprets those signals as sensations, even though the limb is no longer there.
It's like the brain is filling in the gaps, creating a sensory experience that's not actually based on reality.
Exactly. Our perceptions are interpretations created by the brain, not always accurate reflections of the outside world.
Well, this deep dive into the paranormal has been quite the journey. We've explored so many fascinating and often mind-boggling beliefs and phenomena, from levitating monks to attempts to weigh the soul to the possibility of alien abductions. It's been a wild ride.
It has. And I think one of the biggest takeaways for me is this persistent tension between belief and evidence. We humans, we crave meaning and purpose in a world that can often feel random and chaotic, and we're drawn to the extraordinary. But we also have this responsibility to be critical thinkers, to question our assumptions and demand evidence.
It's about finding that balance between being open-minded and skeptical, not dismissing things outright, but also not accepting things blindly.
Exactly. And as we wrap up this exploration, I hope our listeners will continue to engage with these questions, keep exploring the mysteries of the human mind and the universe, and remember that even if these paranormal phenomena turn out to be illusions or misinterpretations, the human capacity for belief and imagination is truly extraordinary.
Well said, and that's a wrap on another deep dive. Thanks for joining us on this journey into the world of the paranormal. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep wondering.